It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up in just a bit, we'll talk to a reporter about the so-called dark money that was spent in support of Wisconsin's mining law.
First, Governor Scott Walker's record on environmental protection is one point of contention between Walker and his Democratic challenger, Mary Burke. As our series on next month's election continues, Chuck Kornbach looks at how green is this governor.
His Boy Scout days, that he would leave a campsite, meaning the environment, cleaner than he found it. It's a promise that some say is at odds with another Walker pledge to help create 250,000 jobs in the state.
More often than not, we just try to listen to our local leaders and follow along. We're glad the DNR and others were involved with that.
Last week in Germantown, Walker spoke at a ribbon cutting for a company's new distribution center. The building isn't yet ready to be occupied, but it's as far along as it is, partly because the Wisconsin DNR moved more quickly on a wetlands review for the site. The governor says faster reviews are part of a wetlands bill he signed 2 years ago.
It helped speed up the process so that when you've got projects like this, we still want to have wetlands, we still want to have good air, good land, clean water, but we want to do so in a timely fashion.
Democrats called the law the Flood Our Families Act, contending more building in wetlands will boost downstream flooding. It's hardly the only green-tinted controversy during the Walker years. Various groups and individuals are also upset with the governor over his handling of renewable energy, environmental enforcement, wolf hunting with dogs, frac sand mining, and then there's that proposed iron ore mine the GTAC Corporation wants to open near Hurley. At last Friday's debate, Democratic challenger Mary Burke said there was a link between GTAC money and a new mining law that critics say weakens protections for land and water.
What we have seen recently is that there was a secret $700,000 campaign contribution from an out-of-state corporation, and Governor Walker changed the rules so that we had that corporation strip mining in our North Woods.
Governor Walker has denied being influenced by campaign dollars and says the DNR is closely reviewing the still unbuilt mine. Burke declined an interview for this story, but her campaign sent a statement in which she promises to bring together all stakeholders to find the right balance between economic development and our public health and natural resources. Those are welcome words in part of the state troubled by contaminated runoff from big farms. Meshek Creek is a stream that flows through eastern Kewaunee County and into Lake Michigan. Family farm owner Lynn Utesh says the waterway often has elevated levels of bacteria due to liquid manure runoff. Utesh says part of the problem goes back to governors before Scott Walker, but Utesh says Walker hasn't done enough to reduce the pollution, and it's time to see what a Burke administration can do.
We know that what we're going to get if we get a re-election of Scott Walker. Mary Burke, I believe that the minimum we will at least get a new secretary of the DNR and a new secretary of the agriculture, which we could hope would be something better.
One group, the Wisconsin League of Conservation Voters, says it's spending $1 million to spread concerns about Walker's environmental record. The governor insists the campsite is cleaner.
We try to do our smart moves that both sustain the environmental standing that we have in the state, but do so in a way that makes us economically sustainable.
Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Over the past few years, there have been plenty of ups and downs in the fight to build an iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin. The proposed mine has been the subject of protests, political fights, and a whole lot of spending from groups hoping to see the mine built.
But there hasn't been much information on where this money came from. According to a new ProPublica investigation, an accidentally released court filing reveals how one company secretly gave money to a nonprofit that helped get favorable mining legislation passed. The story offers a rare look at how money changes hands in a post-Citizens United era.
Joining us now is Theodoric Meyer, reporting fellow at ProPublica, who's been covering this story. Theo, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, that court filing we just mentioned made headlines briefly here in Wisconsin. What was in that court filing that's at the heart of the story you're telling?
It did. So this court filing sort of confirmed something that many lawmakers had suspected but had never been able to prove. A federal appeals court in Chicago posted this filing online for several hours, apparently mistakenly, before taking it down. And reporters at the AP and the Journal Sentinel and elsewhere got their hands on it before it was taken down from the website.
And this showed us where money was coming from for what we often call outside groups, not direct political campaigns or things like that. Why is this so rare that we see this sort of thing?
Yeah, buried deep in the document is a single paragraph saying that the mining company, Göbek Taconite, had given money directly to one of these outside groups, the Wisconsin Club for Growth.
And so who are the big players? Who is donating the money that we're talking about?
And you had asked why it was rare to see this thing. The Wisconsin Club for Growth is a social welfare nonprofit, which means that it is allowed to spend at least some of its money on politics and does not have to disclose its donors, unlike, say, a super PAC, which, plenty of those also spend lots of money in elections.
And this all comes in part from the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling. What's the line from there to here?
Yeah, Citizens United and, sort of related rulings around the same time allowed corporations as well as unions to spend sort of unlimited amounts on politics. So since Citizens United, came down in 2010, you've seen this huge surge in outside money, both by groups that disclose their donors, like super PACs, and nonprofits that don't have to disclose their donors.
Now, going back to the mining story in specific, we had this concept, this idea of having an iron mine in northern Wisconsin. There was work on rewriting Wisconsin's mining laws that would change the way these are regulated. There was a version of this law supported by the company involved. But what happened then when this got to the state Senate?
So the company had said about 6 months after it first announced that it wanted to build this mine, that new legislation was something that was pretty much necessary for them to build it. So I wanted to see sort of at what points these two nonprofit groups, the WMC and the Wisconsin Club for Growth, sort of entered the debate and the battle over the law along the, almost 2 years that were spent fighting over it.
So how did they do that? How did they get involved after a Senate vote shot down this mining plan?
Well, they got involved, actually, almost immediately after it became public that Göbek was working with lawmakers on this bill. The WMC had brochures ready to go way back in May 2011, before the bill had even really become public, and started running radio ads shortly thereafter. This group also played a hand in writing the bill along with the company.
And then lawmakers who spoke out or voted against this particular mining bill, what was the reaction from funders and from the groups you're talking about?
Well, a lot of this came down to needing sort of one more vote to get this through the state Senate. And a lot of pressure was put on Senator Dale Schultz, who is a Republican in the Senate, who was sort of undecided on whether or not to vote for the bill. Lobbyists who worked both for the company and for one of these groups visited him on several occasions. And the group that received money directly from the company, the Wisconsin Club for Growth, launched this robocalling campaign against him in which it urged voters around the state to call his office and tell Schultz to vote for the bill.
And how did you talk to Senator Schultz? How did he respond to that?
I spoke to Senator Schultz as well as some of his staffers, he sort of expressed concern, as he had before, that the bill didn't have enough environmental protections, and frustration that these groups, particularly the Wisconsin Club for Growth, were smearing him, and he didn't know where their money was coming from, as nobody did. One staffer told me that during a meeting with both lobbyists from the WMC and from the company, He told them that you could tell your buddies if they're making these phone calls in my district, they can keep doing them because they're making me a folk hero.
And you pointed out an anecdote I hadn't heard. I guess WMC, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, had given Senator Schultz an award, but changed their attitude toward him in the midst of this mining debate.
Yeah, they give out these awards every year called the Working for Wisconsin Awards, that any legislator who, you know, votes the way they sort of suggest a certain percentage of the time gets one of these awards. So since it's just done by percentage of votes, Schultz had voted with them during that session, I think 88% of the time. So he got one of these awards, even though, you know, the WMC was quite displeased with him when they gave it to him because he'd opposed this legislation. So, you know, a lot of people have sort of tried to, you know, paint him as a liberal. And on a lot of the votes that he took in that session, he was actually in line with their position.
And then in the elections that followed, you say that these groups and their funders targeted a key Democratic state senator. How did they do that?
True. So as I'm sure your listeners remember, the original mining bill failed in the spring of 2012. And so these groups sort of turned their attention towards influencing the 2012 elections and trying to flip the Senate to Republican control. So in particular, they poured a huge amount of money, almost $2 million, according to estimates, into this one particular race in Oshkosh, where State Senator Jessica King was running for re-election.
And she ultimately lost. And she, you talked to her, she blamed her loss in part on that spending.
Yeah, she spent less than $300,000 on her whole campaign. Her opponent spent only a little bit more. You know, together these groups poured in a huge amount of money and were able to buy, you know, a lot of TV ads in Green Bay that she credits with, you know, turning the race against her. She lost by only 600 votes out of more than 85,000 people who voted. So she lost very, very narrowly. And she thinks that if this money hadn't, you know, come in and funded these groups, that she might have won that race.
We're talking with ProPublica reporter Theo Meyer. He wrote a story about the secret money that went into crafting Wisconsin's mining law, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. We're talking with ProPublica reporting fellow Theo Meyer. In a recent story, he looked at what's been called dark money in political campaigns and what went into crafting Wisconsin's mining law. You can join in with your questions and your comments and your thoughts on the influence of money on political decision-making and on elections in the Citizens United world at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So, Theo, this phrase, social welfare groups, these are groups that are organized not solely for political grounds. How much gray area is there right now in what they can and can't spend money on and whether they have to disclose things?
Well, they can spend money on politics, but their primary purpose is supposed to be, you know, sort of what's in their name, social welfare. So they're supposed to devote most of their efforts to that. They are required, when they file their annual tax returns, to tell the IRS how much they're spending on politics. So, you know, the agency can determine that they're not spending most of their efforts or their money on it. Both the WMC and the Wisconsin Club for Growth told the IRS they spent no money on politics in 2012. But I asked several professors and experts who study this sort of thing to take a look at one of their ads, and they told me, all of them, that that it definitely qualified as political activity and that they should have reported that spending to the IRS.
But is this one of those things where if my ad doesn't say vote for candidate X or vote against candidate Y, I can make a case that this is about an issue, this is education on something that's going to benefit the public? It is not, in fact, a political ad?
Yeah. These groups would definitely probably say that these are issue ads, but the definition is it's sort of different depending on who you're talking to. And at least under IRS rules, the way they define it, you don't have to say, you know, vote for Scott Walker or vote for Mary Burke to qualify. If you run it, you know, within a certain time period before the election, and if the ad does certain other things, you know, under their rules, it qualifies as political activity.
We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Kennedy on the line in Madison. Kennedy, hi.
Hi, yes. My question for your caller is just, you know, when does he see this stopping, that all this political money is going to, you know, determine elections, and that, you know, the people really no longer have a say in what is happening, you know, for their state or in the country?
Kennedy, thanks for the call. Theo, under the current state of affairs, do you see anything changing in terms of how much money is in the political system?
I think the only change that most people expect is for it to increase. At least at the federal level, far more money is being spent in 2014 than in 2010, the last time we had midterms. And I think, you know, almost all observers expect far more money to be spent in 2016 than was spent in 2012.
Now, a big issue in the story you're telling is one of disclosure. The groups you're talking about, and many like them, don't have to say who donated their money. There's wiggle room, evidently, on what they report as far as political spending. Talking to politicians, people involved in this story, did you get a sense that they feel like this is just the tip of the iceberg, what we found out about this particular case?
This is sort of a rare instance of, you know, being able to connect the dots. And it was only possible because of, you know, what that appeals court says was a fluke, accidentally posting this document that was supposed to be sealed. We almost never get a look at who is actually donating to these nonprofits that don't disclose their donors. There's really only a handful of instances in which we have. So it's very rare to even be able to understand at this level what is going on.
And you talked to lawmakers, some Democrats on the record, at least one Republican off the record, who expressed surprise at the amount of money put in by the mining company into these groups to influence this decision.
Yeah. I spoke to one Republican lawmaker who didn't want to be named, but who ultimately voted for the bill. And he said that he didn't think his colleagues were aware of the amount that GoGebic was spending, or that it was donating to this group, that it had given this $700,000, you know, until well after Scott Walker had signed this legislation into law.
Knowing what we know now with the dots that are connected, is anyone raising questions as to the legality of these donations and the political activity they went into?
To my knowledge, no one has raised sort of those flags. The John Doe investigation has focused, of course, on the sort of potential or possible coordination between the Walker campaign in 2012 and between these groups. But I think everyone expects it will be a long time before that fully plays out.
I know in the past you've reported on Citizens United and campaign spending. When these documents were released, what did that feel like? Was this a windfall for you to actually have some data to work with?
It is just an extremely rare look at being able to sort of unmask at least one of the donors behind an effort like this. Usually, you know, you're only able to unmask people like this when someone subpoenas, you know, bank records from a group like this, and that has happened very rarely.
And do you see any efforts underway to change the current state of affairs, to crack down on this sort of outside group spending with undisclosed donations?
The IRS is currently working on new rules that would spell out a little more clearly what these nonprofits are allowed to do, but those will definitely not be ready for this election cycle, obviously. And, you know, some lawyers I've talked to think that it won't be ready for even the 2016 elections, so that might be a long way off.
Theo, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Theodoric Meyer, reporting fellow at ProPublica. We've got a link to his story. In Wisconsin, dark money got a company what it wanted. You can find that link over at the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the president canceled his travel plans today to discuss the country's response to Ebola with his cabinet. We'll check out the political response to Ebola in our weekly look at Congress.
First, we're talking about a federal judge's decision to block the political campaign coordination law in Wisconsin.
U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa said state election officials and a prosecutor in Milwaukee can no longer limit the ability of candidates and outside groups to collaborate. Earlier this year, Judge Randa issued a similar decision that halted an investigation into collaboration between Governor Scott Walker's campaign and conservative groups during the recall election. That investigation is also known as John Doe 2.
Here to break down the news and give us some context is Patrick Marley. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on again.
So let's start with this ruling. What exactly did Judge Randa say?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
What exactly did Judge Randa rule yesterday?
So he ruled in a lawsuit brought by Citizens for Responsible Government. They're the group that started the recall movement 15 years ago in Milwaukee County. They say that they want to have a website and ad campaign where they work directly with candidates. But they feared to do that because the Government Accountability Board, the State Elections Agency, and Milwaukee County's DA, John Chisholm, have a view of the law that you cannot do that. And so Randa yesterday said, yes, they can go ahead and do that, that the GAB and Chisholm cannot enforce their view of the law that groups and candidates can work together.
Now, on what grounds did the Citizens for Responsible Government advocates sue the Government Accountability Board and the Milwaukee County District Attorney?
Well, they are saying under the First Amendment that they have that right, that as long as they don't engage in what's known as express advocacy, where they directly tell people, vote for this candidate or vote against that candidate, that they can associate with whoever they want to and run any kinds of communications that they want. So all they have to do is avoid the so-called magic words. They can't say vote for or support, but they can say that candidate A is a great person and candidate B is a terrible person. You see lots of ads on TV around election time that the normal voter wouldn't realize is not technically defined as a campaign ad. These are ones that might end with saying, call Senator so-and-so and tell them to change their stance on X or Y, and it runs just before an election.
So does this mean essentially we're talking about issue ads?
Right. This is what they're saying. Because they're doing issue ads, they believe that they can work directly with candidates, and Judge Randa said that they're right, that they can.
Now, one of the twists in this story is that the defendants didn't have a lawyer until the day before the decision was announced, and that lawyer had asked for more time to respond but didn't get the chance before the decision came down. Why did that decision come so quickly?
So it is an odd wrinkle. The CRG sued only this month and asked for immediate relief because they said they wanted to engage in this before the November 4 election. The Attorney General refused to represent Chisholm and the Accountability Board because of other cases related to this John Doe that he's involved in, and saying he does not agree with their interpretation of the law. So when the Attorney General refused to represent them, it then fell to Governor Walker's office to appoint counsel for them. Governor Walker's chief counsel asked Judge Randa for more time to find attorneys and to get a contract with them. Judge Randa said he wanted a quick resolution to this and gave them a matter of days to respond, even though they were telling him that they didn't have attorneys. And they finally got an attorney on Monday. The attorney on Tuesday asked Randa for another week to respond because he'd just been hired. Judge Randa said he was ruling because the election was so close and that the attorneys could try to make their case for him to change his mind a week from now.
So with the election so mere 3 weeks away, is this ruling likely to affect the elections?
Well, CRG is now free to start their campaign. They I don't know that they have yet. I mean, they just got the ruling yesterday. They say they want to start a website called Take Charge Wisconsin. It does not appear to be active to me so far. The candidates that they are working with are some county board members. Those are the elected officials that they're working with. So it's not, they're not saying that they're working with candidates in major races. This would presumably give candidates for governor, for attorney general, for the legislature to start working with outside groups if they wanted to. We have not heard so far that anybody plans to do that. If they were to do that, they would have to be aware that, you know, this continues to be in litigation, that appeals could be filed, that Randa could change his views, or that another court could rule a different way.
How does this ruling affect campaign finance law in Wisconsin?
Well, it's an important ruling. It's not the last ruling on the issue. I think that we will see other courts, perhaps the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal court in Chicago for our region, getting involved at some stage in this case. There are three cases before the state Supreme Court on aspects of the campaign finance law through the John Doe case, and that court could rule at some point. So I think at some point, and I don't know if it's weeks or months or a year or more away, we're going to get some finality on this issue, but at the moment it's extremely fluid.
If it were to stand for any amount of time, how significant would that be?
Well, it depends on your point of view. The groups like CRG and the Wisconsin Club for Growth believe that this has been the law all along and they've been able to collaborate with candidates if they want to. So they would say that it would be no change at all. The detractors of that view say that it would be a significant change because you could have candidates in groups working together in a way that would then disguise contributions to a candidate. In other words, normally if a candidate goes out and raises money, there's only a certain amount they can raise from any particular donor, and that's all publicly disclosed. For instance, in a race for governor, the maximum amount they can raise is $10,000. Now they could go raise money for a third party of, say, $1 million from a given donor, and if that person gave to groups that were structured the right way, that would never be known by the public.
Has the Supreme Court given any indication about how it feels or would feel about this kind of collaboration?
The state Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court?
The U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has changed a lot of laws in recent years on campaign speech, with Citizens United, and more recently this case known as McCutcheon, and the court has had closely divided cases that have tended to be on the side of less regulation, not more. However, the critics of those decisions point out that the court has also drawn a line between activities that are truly independent by outside groups, allowing them a lot more freedom, and groups that work with a candidate, putting them in a different category.
Now, this is part of the larger ongoing issues behind the John Doe investigation. How significant is this ruling as the next part of that story, which seems to still be unfolding?
Well, I mean, if the Citizens for Responsible Government prevail in their case, it would seem to me to be a significant help to Governor Walker and the groups allied with him who have been under investigation, because if the courts were to say that all this activity is perfectly legal, then there wouldn't be any problem for him. Now, those groups say that, they've already had some court decisions that have been favorable to them. This would be something else that would strengthen their hand in that matter.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of the book More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin.
It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today Politics and Congress editor Paul Singer. The president has canceled political travel today to meet with his cabinet to discuss the country's response to Ebola. This morning, news of a second infection of a Dallas nurse was announced.
And as we stand 3 weeks away from midterm elections, a lot of attention has been focused on a possible Republican takeover of the Senate. But what's happening in the House? A political report suggests Republicans could establish their tightest hold there since Truman's presidency.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, thanks for being with us again.
My pleasure. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm real good. Well, let's start with Ebola. What role does Congress play potentially in responding to a threat like this?
Well, you'll remember that about a month ago, Congress passed a supplemental spending bill that included $88 million for the administration's response on Ebola. And then a couple of weeks later, they approved a Defense Department, we call it a reprogramming. Basically, the Defense Department wanted to move some money out of one set of accounts into another set of accounts. That was another $750 million. At this point, you know, the White House says they are in the process of allocating $1 billion to Ebola response. So far, they've only allocated about $311 million of that, but that's kind of, you know, it takes a while to get rid of $1 billion. So at the moment, honestly, there's not a lot Congress needs to do or, for that matter, can do. They're not even here. I think the next turn of the screw becomes the current funding bill that expires December 11th. We will need a new funding bill to keep the government open for the rest of the year, that is, for the rest of the fiscal year. I think there's no doubt there will be talk about increasing allocations for Ebola and for probably for CDC to develop vaccines and stuff like that in that bill. But that won't be until early December.
Now, there's no shortage of world crises these days. So with so much competing bad news, how has the conversation in Congress on Ebola evolved over the last several months?
Well, you know, it's funny. We were just talking about the other day, whatever happened to NSA spying? You remember when that was a big deal? And we went and did some calling around, and it registers nowhere in the polls. It registers nowhere in campaigns. Now it's all about Ebola, you know, this week. You know, what now happens is a blame game starts where you'll see Democrats accusing Republicans of starving the CDC and other government agencies that would be and that are the primary responders to Ebola. And you see Republicans responding that, in fact, these agencies have not been starved. They've simply been misdirecting their resources that they've been given. And, in fact, they're doing fine in funding. It's just a question of dumb spending of that money. So Congress, in its typical mood at this point, they're not here. They're not working on much, but they are blaming each other for what's not going right.
And the editorial board at USA Today published an opinion piece suggesting that politicians were overreacting, using this for political gain, as you were just kind of outlining. You know, you're separate from the editorial board, but have we seen that much in the nature of alarmism in the response?
Alarmism is there. I mean, you know, honestly, we have this conversation every morning at our morning news meeting, right? Are we being alarmist? Mm. You know, are we telling people about an important and scary health situation, or are we flaming or fanning the flames of panic? It's, you know, I honestly have very mixed feelings about both our coverage and everybody else's coverage. You know, we want to be responsible. We want to be telling the story. And I think politicians have the same problem. They want to be telling the story. They want to be informing their constituents. And to some degree, of course, they're running for office. They want to be making a political point about the philosophical decisions that lawmakers have made and how those either help or hurt us in these situations. But at the same time, you don't want to be telling people, you know, screaming fire in a crowded movie theater.
Now, turning to midterm elections, Republican control of the Senate is being talked about these days as likely. And in Kentucky, the Senate Democrats' national campaign is no longer buying ads for Mitch McConnell's challenger, Alison Lundergan Grimes.
Right, now, but I'll warn you on that. I'll warn you on that. That is true. But she's also got a $5 million war chest of her own. So it's not like she's gone away.
So
but
is
yes,
this not right. as significant as it may seem to be that they're giving up on her because it seems likely that she's going to lose, which is one narrative that's out there?
I think she's likely to lose, but it's a pretty close race. One narrative out there is that the Democrats are abandoning her because they think she's going to lose. Another narrative is that the Democrats are shifting their money elsewhere because they have less well-funded challengers that they really want to try and push, or, for that matter, incumbents they want to save. I think winning Kentucky has always been a bit of a pie-in-the-sky chance for them. You don't usually beat the sitting Republican leader, minority leader in the Senate. I think they think they've got a pretty good shot, the best shot they're going to have. And I think they think that spending a lot more money in that race is not as fruitful as spending money where they really need to rescue some endangered incumbents, whether it's in Iowa, or, in fact, not an incumbent there, but a Democratic seat, or in Louisiana or in Arkansas where there are incumbents. That is my suspicion of the calculus.
There's been a lot of talk about the Senate possibly changing control. Less talk about the House. Everybody pretty much agrees that the Republicans are going to stay in control. At one point, though, Democrats were talking like they might make limited gains there. That seems to be changing. Is it looking likely that Republicans will score, you know, further wins in the House?
Yeah. Democrats were talked about wins in the House. Nobody else was. That was never really likely to happen. The guesses all along have been somewhere between 6 and 10 pickup seats for the House Republicans, which would solidify their majority. I think the question is, do they pick up 20 seats? That would be fairly dramatic. And would, as you I think you're mentioning at the top of the show, you know, establish the strongest majority for them in many years. It would also, frankly, be something of a validation of John Boehner's speakership. Remember, you know, at the beginning of the year, people were talking about, oh, John Boehner is weakened by his Tea Party caucus, and the Republicans are going to vote for somebody else for speaker, and, you know, it's proved they can't actually steer this ship well. I mean, if the Republicans win 5 or 6 seats, okay, you know, maybe we still have that argument. If Republicans win 20, suddenly Boehner looks like a champ.
And now let's look at some of the issues in the congressional races. A while back, we were talking a lot about Obamacare as an important talking point in Republican campaigns. Just a few weeks out, are things shaping up that way?
Well, you still see some of it. It's still of interest to people. What's interesting to me is that some of the Democrats have begun defending their votes on Obamacare. They don't call it that, of course. They say stuff like, I'm very proud that I voted to allow you to be covered for pre-existing conditions or to allow your children to stay on your health care plan. Right. They never say, I voted for Obamacare. The name is still toxic. I don't think Republicans are making as much headway as they thought they might on Obamacare. Certainly not, you know, 9 months ago when it looked like this was going to be the issue of the campaign, because they've got a bunch of other things to talk about now, right? They've got government incompetence in general. I think there is a sense that the country is drifting in the wrong direction, that the government has not been functional, and that Democrats and President Obama particularly are to blame. That's been the Republican talking point. I think that Obamacare is part of that, certainly, and in certain races it can be a very influential issue, but it has not turned out to be the star of the campaign season that we expected.
Well, has everything just sort of disappeared from the radar, as you were just saying, sort of in the wake of ISIS and Ebola in terms of possible campaign talking points?
You know, what has really emerged as the campaign talking point, particularly for Republicans, is Obama bad. And it's everything from Ebola to ISIS to, the economic recovery is not good enough to Obamacare. I mean, the major themes here have been your Democratic candidate X, insert name here, is too close to Barack Obama, and Barack Obama has been bad. And with Obama's performance ratings so low in the public eye, it works. I mean, he was supposed to go on a campaign trip today for the first time all year, basically being on the stage with a Democratic candidate. And, of course, that got canceled so we could stay home and talk about Ebola.
Well, speaking of bad news for President Obama, we speak to former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta today, latest Obama cabinet member to write a memoir with some criticisms of the president. Is it rare to see this kind of criticism from his almost inner circle while still in office?
Not really. I'm surprised to hear it from Leon Panetta because, we've known him in Washington for years, and he's always been a fairly temperate kind of guy. He was a member of Congress. He was, Secretary of Defense. He was the CIA. I mean, he's had every position in Washington you can imagine, and you don't expect him to be the guy to blab and kiss and tell, as it were. But no, if you want to leave the administration and make a little bit of money on your book, it helps if you say something sexy and nasty about the president, and it happens all the time. Every administration around this time, you will see former administration official writes books saying, my bosses were morons.
Is this in any way, do you think, a move by Panetta on behalf maybe of Panetta and some others behind him of looking ahead to the next presidential election?
I don't know. I mean, I think mostly it's a move to sell books. Whether it's a, I don't doubt Mr. Panetta's view, right, that he feels like he was not listened to and bad advice was being pursued by the administration, and they were just trying to get out of Afghanistan and Iraq as quickly as possible. I mean, I don't doubt that. That's not he's not the only one who's ever said that either. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's anything more strategic to it than that, that you say it, you get paid a lot of money to write books that say it, you then go on the talk show circuit and talk some more about it, and then you move on.
Paul, thanks a lot for being on the talk show circuit with us today.
Yeah, where's my check?
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to give us the latest from Congress.